Today we're going to be talking about World War One. I think it's a bit interesting, you know, of course, World War One, the crisis leading to World War One, began with an assassination. And, you know, today is the anniversary of another assassination, November 22nd. It's 48 years since President Kennedy was assassinated. I remember that very well. I'm sure that rather dates me. I was just started 11th grade in high school. I was in a high school gym class, and we got the news around 20 to 11 that President Kennedy had been shot. I'll never forget that day. But that doesn't have anything to do with the lecture date, but I just thought I'd mention it since today is November 22nd. Now, remember last week we were discussing whether the Spanish-American War was a break with the traditional American foreign policy, and I argued that it was because, remember, our traditional foreign policy was to stay out of European power politics, and this is one we followed throughout the 19th century. And then someone wanted to know, well, how did we go against our traditional foreign policy in the Spanish-American War? And what I argued was, well, we were engaged in imperialist rivalries with the European powers, especially in taking over the Philippines. So I thought there was a good case that the Spanish-American War was a break with traditional American foreign policy, but you can see somebody arguing the contrary. Somebody could say, well, we didn't really get involved in any wars with the European powers, much we were at war with Spain, but it was really didn't involve us in any real participation in European power politics because Spain was a very weak power. But as far as World War One is concerned, which we're talking about today, there really can't be any doubt that we were breaking with the traditional policy of non-intervention. This was really a gigantic intervention in European power politics. And in the war, there were about 116,000 American military deaths and about 205,000 military wounded. Now, this is far less, even though that's a lot, we should take account. Remember, the U.S., as I'll go into the lecture later, came into the war only in April 1917. Of course, the war ended November 11, 1918. So the U.S. was just in for about a year and a half, and the war last started in August 1914, so the war the U.S. wasn't in it. And if you look at the losses of the European powers, they're much more. For example, France had about 1,400,000 military deaths, and Germany about 2 million. So this was really a lot more, but still the U.S. Certainly a very big thing that we were involved in World War One. Now, one thing to keep in mind is, as I say, this was a big break with the non-interventionist policy. The 19th century would say, well, we're not going to get involved in European power politics following the teaching of Washington's farewell address. Remember, I spoke about that last week, and the Monroe Doctrine, which really confined U.S. foreign policy interests to the Americas, it said really to the European powers, you can handle things in Europe, we won't intervene, but we don't want you intervening anymore in Latin America. So certainly World War One, we were going into Europe in a very big way, but it doesn't follow that once we did that it was inevitable that once we'd done that, then we would just be a non-interventionist power in Europe from then on. That once we'd taken that gigantic step in World War One, then we were stuck with being an interventionist power, and we really can forget about non-intervention. Because in the 1920s and the early 1930s, there was a retreat from the interventionist policy of World War I. We didn't get back to totally to the traditional foreign policy, but we did to more extent than you would suspect. There was a retreat afterwards. So there's nothing inevitable about the U.S. becoming a world power and participating in European power politics just because we become involved in World War I. Now, in considering the how the U.S. got involved, I think there's a basic mistake we have to avoid. Now, today, the U.S. and Britain are always allied. We're always on the same side. So we might think that America was bound to come in on the British side. Once we know that Britain was involved in the war, then wouldn't we think, well, the U.S. is going to have to come in on the British side because Britain is our big ally, so of course we're going to support them. But if we think this way, we're really reading history backwards. The Swiss historian who wrote on history of historical right, Edward Fader, once said that every historian has to decide whether he's going to write about events from the perspective of what was happening to the people at the time or from the perspective of what we know today. So, and he was suggesting that the right way to approach history is we look at events from the perspective of people, what was taking place at the time. So at the time in 1914, people didn't think that we're always on the British side, so we have to come in on their side. Things were quite different. This may be the way most people look at it now, but it wasn't the way people looked at it then. It wasn't that, well, we're always going to come in just be on the British side because they're our traditional ally. And the fact was that the U.S. and Britain did not become close diplomatically until around 1900. And in fact, there was almost a war between the U.S. and Britain in 1895. What had happened in 1895 was there was a dispute between Venezuela and British Guiana, which was a boundary dispute. And apparently there was some gold that was found in the disputed area. So each side said, well, this is really in our territory. So there was a big argument about it. So America invoked the Monroe Doctrine and said to the British, well, we insist that you submit this dispute to arbitration. You can't go in and force the Venezuelans to accept your view of the matter. You have to submit this to arbitration. So the British Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, he was one of the great leaders of the British Conservative parties, one of the most important British Prime Minister, sort of an intellectual defender of conservatism. So he told the American Secretary of State, Richard Olney, he was pretty blunt. He said, you can invoke the Monroe Doctrine all you like, but it isn't part of international law. It's just a unilateral declaration. We don't care. You can say the Monroe Doctrine requires us to accept arbitration, but what do we care about that? We don't accept the Monroe Doctrine. That's just something American policy is stated, but we don't care about that. And that was a big shock to the American State Department that the British were saying this. And it looked like, for a while, it looked like there was going to really be big trouble. And there was even people wondering, was there going to be a war because the British were refusing the American demand for arbitration. But war was averted. And I think the British made some conciliatory gestures, and then so they eventually did have arbitration of this dispute. And after that, relations between the two countries improve. Now, in the Spanish-American War, which we talked about last week, the British government at first seemed to favor Spain, but the colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, he was very, was someone who was British, very anxious to have trade with the imperial protection. He wanted the colonies and the various nations such as Canada and Australia that were part of the British Empire to be more closely linked to Britain. He was very pro-American, and the British press was also very pro-American. So even though the government at first seemed to favor Spain, later on, under the influence of his colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, they were fairly favorable to America in the Spanish-American War, and this also improved relations between Britain and America. Now, Joseph Chamberlain, you probably heard of the Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, you know, the famous one who was at the Munich Conference, and what person's always associated with appeasement in the 1930s. He was Joseph Chamberlain's son. Neville Chamberlain was Joseph Chamberlain's son. And another son of Joseph Chamberlain, Austen Chamberlain, was the British Foreign Secretary in the 1920s. Foreign Secretary is what the British call the Foreign Minister. It's equivalent to American Secretary of State. So it was a very famous family, the Chamberlains, in British politics. So there was around 1900, there was a fundamental change in British foreign policy. For most of the latter part of the 19th century, Britain followed a policy that's been called splendid isolation. That wasn't a name that Lord Salisbury, who's the principal person associated with this policy, called it, but that was what other people called it. And what the idea of splendid isolation would be was that the British didn't get involved in alliances with other countries, just like America under Jeff Washington and Jefferson had avoided entangling alliances. The British in the latter part of the 19th century just went their own way. They didn't get involved in alliances. But this changed toward the beginning of the 20th century with the agreement with France, which was called the Anglo-French Entente. An Entente is a diplomatic agreement, but it's not a formal alliance. It just doesn't have the same status in the alliance, but it's sort of an understanding between the two powers. Anglo-French Entente, 1904, settled various colonial disputes between Britain and France, and after that they were able to get along much better. And there was similarly an Anglo-Russian Convention, 1907, and this settled disputes, say, in Persia with and other places with Russia, and so England and Russia were now able to get along together. And of course, France and Russia had been allied since 1894. So it was involved here. Why was Britain changing this policy of splendid isolation? British were very concerned with the rising power of Germany. Germany was developing industrially much more than it was the fastest rising industrial power in Europe. So Britain was thought, and there were various people in Germany who wanted to build up a big navy, and the British were afraid of some that the Germans were going to challenge their supremacy on the seas. Britain was by far the dominant power on the seas, and the British were afraid that Germany was going to get much stronger and challenge them. So Britain saw the need for alliances, and because of that, this led to better relations with America also. Britain is saying, well, we've got to cultivate these Americans, because if we're involved in any struggles in the future, especially with Germany, we want to make sure we have the Americans on our side. But even considering these facts that the British were becoming more interested in closer alliances with France and Russia and also with America, they were friendlier than they'd been since the 1895 boundary dispute over Venezuela. It didn't follow that America would support Britain in European war. Again, if we think that, that would be reading history backwards. So we've considered that we have to avoid this fallacy of thinking the Americans are going to come in automatically on the side of the British. So now we have to say, well, what about the crisis of 1914 itself? How did the war start? Well, basically, there were two rival alliance systems in Europe in 1914. Now, the first one we've already mentioned, this is the Triple Entente. This is Britain, France, and Russia. Remember, I mentioned that there was the Franco-Russian alliance of 1894. There was the Anglo-French Entente 1904, and the Anglo-Russian Convention 1907. So these three countries, Britain, France, and Russia, were in one of these alliance systems, the Triple Entente. Now the rival system is the Triple Alliance. So this is Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Italy. So you have three countries against three countries. But even though Italy was in the Triple Alliance, Italy really didn't support her alliance powers. And eventually, as you know, Italy entered the war against Germany and Austria-Hungary. So really, the Triple Alliance was really a dual alliance between Germany and Austria-Hungary. And they were against the Triple Entente, Britain, France, and Russia. So as you no doubt know, the immediate crisis began with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914. Remember, the Archduke was the heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary. He was the grand nephew of the Emperor Franz Josef. He didn't have a title Crown Prince, unlike Crown Prince Rudolf. He was the heir to the throne. So Sarajevo was in Bosnia, which was part of the Austrian Empire. But Serbia, there a lot of the Serbs thought that because Bosnia should be part of Serbia, so they didn't like the fact that the Austrians were in control of Bosnia. Bosnia, I think, had been incorporated into the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1908, so the Serbs didn't like that. And to make matters worse, June 28th was the Serbian national holiday, which was called St. Vitus's Day. So the Serbs weren't happy that Archduke Franz Ferdinand was coming to visit Sarajevo on that day. They thought it was kind of rubbing their face in it. And when the Archduke was assassinated, there's some evidence, although this is a matter that's disputed, that there were officials in the Serbian government who knew about it. The dispute is on how high up this was. Certainly, there was the head of the Serbian intelligence service, it was called Colonel Dmitrijević, was aware of what was happening. And there's some indication that the Prime Minister Nikola Pašić also knew something was afoot, although how much he knew was been argued about. So this is we have the heir to the throne has been assassinated, and there's some indication the Serbian government had something to do with it, although, of course, the Serbian government denied that. So the Austrians once thought, well, they're going to use this occasion to deal with Serbia. They really didn't like the fact that the Serbians had been agitating against their rule. They were causing a lot of trouble. So the Austrians said, well, this is going to give us a good chance to really take care of Serbia for good. And early in July, the Austrians received a guarantee of support from Germany. Kaiser Wilhelm II thought the other European powers would be shocked by the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. So he thought, well, the other European powers are going to let Austria go in and wipe up the Serbians, because even if some of them don't like it, like he would, of course, be aware that Russians wouldn't like this, he thought, well, they're going to realize if you have the Franz Ferdinand assassinated with Serbian complicity, there's a threat to the monarchies everywhere. Of course, Russia at that time was a monarchy under the Tsar Nicholas II. So the Kaiser guaranteed support to Austria. He said, you can go in, take over Serbia, you can invade them, we're going to support you. So what Austria did, they waited 3 weeks, and then on July 23rd, they issued a 48-hour ultimatum to Serbia. And the key demand, the ultimatum had a lot of different points to it, but the key demand was that Austria could conduct an investigation of the assassination in Serbia. So this was kind of an insult to Serbian sovereignty, and the Austrians were quite aware the Serbians were extremely unlikely to accept this, because what Austria was saying was, look, we want our officials to be able to go into Austria and conduct the investigation themselves. So it's very unlikely that one nation would allow this, just like supposing, say somebody in America was assassinated, we think the Mexican government is involved, so say the Mexican government, we want to go into Mexico and start investigating which people in your government knew about this, the Mexicans wouldn't be very happy about it, they would probably refuse. So as everybody expected, Serbia gave a kind of very evasive answer, and the Austrians then declared war on them. Now, the key question we have to understand, if we want to know, well, we have now a local war between Austria and Serbia. Now, of course, any war is a serious matter, but that doesn't get us a European war. All we have here is the Austrians are angry that Franz Ferdinand has been assassinated, and they say, well, they're going to use this as a way of excuse or justification for taking care of Serbia. They're sick of Serbian nationalism. They're going to let the Serbians kind of take over Serbia, really strike them a mortal blow. So we have to ask, well, how did this local war become a European war? Now, Fritz Fischer, who's currently the most influential historian of the war's origin, claimed a very influential book that came out in 1961 that Germany wanted a European war. So his thesis, Fritz Fischer, thought that when Germany said to Austria early in July, we'll back you for action against Serbia, he thought the Germans realized that by doing that, they would probably ignite a European war, but he thought that's what they wanted. They were getting upset that Russia was developing very much, was developing in industry and population, and they were afraid that as Russia continued to grow, that this would threaten them. So according to Fisher, the Germans decided to launch a preventive war to assert their dominance on the European continent. Now, incidentally, Fisher, of course, this sounds like a very sort of anti-German nationalist view. He's saying the Germans were responsible for the war. But in his earlier career, Fisher had been a member of the Nazi Party, so he kind of shifted to a more very critical view, very critical of German nationalism, but he himself had been one kind of supporter of the Nazis. So Fisher's views were countering the revisionists of the 1920s and 30s, such as Harry Elmer Barnes and Sidney Fay, who said, well, it wasn't true that Germany had planned the war. It was, the war guilt was divided between the European powers, and they stressed that we can't say that they sort of anticipated Fisher's argument. They said, no, he's wrong. And I'm very much inclined to think the revisionists had the better of the case. But the revisionist view, as the view that says Germany was not principally responsible for the war, is not the dominant view among historians today, although there's some indications that the dominance of the Fisher's thesis has been challenged. Now, what the revisionist pointed out was, at the time in 1914, mobilization of the armies was really crucial, because when mobilization means calling up the armies, sending them on the trains and getting them ready to fight, and if this was such a difficult process involving mobilizing millions of people, but once it got going, it would be very difficult to stop. And if one side mobilized and the other side didn't do anything, that would put them at an enormous disadvantage in any fight. So what the revisionists pointed out was that Russia was the first major power to mobilize. They started mobilizing a week before the Germans did. And when the Russians did this, they were aware that if they did this, Germany would think this was making war inevitable, but they did it anyway. And it appeared the reason the Russians did this was they wanted to get control of the Straits of Constantinople. This would be very helpful for them. It was a historic aim in Russian foreign policy to get control of the Straits of Constantinople. So they, according to the revisionists, the Russians thought, well, we can use this crisis caused to European crisis to risk starting a war, because then we'll be able to get control of the Straits of Constantinople. And one person who's especially important in this plan to get control of the Straits of Constantinople was the Russian foreign minister, whose name is Sergei Sazonov. And according to Barnes in his 1926 book, Genesis of the World War, Sazonov and Alexander Izvolsky, who was the Russian ambassador to Paris, who had previously been Russian foreign minister, their idea was they wanted a war to get control of the Straits. Now, I should say, this is not the view that most historians have accepted, although I find it a very strong argument, but you should be aware it's not the most accepted position. I think they make a good case. I saw there was a recent book by, just came out with Harvard, by McMeekin, that makes a similar argument that the Russians were starting the war to try to get control of the Strait. And also, France under President Raymond Poincaré, there should be an accent over the E, but I couldn't figure out how to do the accent. But Poincaré with an accent. So he wanted to recover Alsace-Lorraine. Remember, this is the provinces that were taken away from France after the German victory in the war between those two countries, 1870 to 1871. So the idea of revisionists was that, especially Harold Barnes, was that Sazonov and Izvolsky wanted to take over the Straits, and the French president, René Poincaré, wanted to recover Alsace-Lorraine. So they, the Russians decided to mobilize their army to do this, even though they knew that war would probably result. So that's in contrast with the view there was a German guarantee to Austria that was really the main thing causing the war. In Fritz Fischer's view, the Germans did that because they wanted a war. Now, how we got the British into this? Well, the British had really committed themselves to entering the war on France's side, but the British government hadn't told Parliament about this. They had a secret understanding with France that they were going to enter the war on the French side, but if they disclosed that to Parliament, they might have been able to still get into the war. They would have caused a lot of dispute with people in Parliament who wouldn't have wanted to get into the war, and then they would have said to the British government, well, why did you make these secret understandings without telling us? And it would cause a good deal of trouble. But while the British were deciding, the British government were deciding what to do, Germany violated Belgian neutrality, because the German war plan, which is called the Schlieffen Plan, the plan was, while the Russian army was getting ready, it was completing its mobilization, Germany would make a quick strike against France, and to do that, their plan called for them to go through Belgium, which was a neutral country. Belgium didn't have any quarrel with Germany, but the Germans said, well, we got to go through Belgium to get it to France, and we can make promises afterwards that we'll restore Belgium. Military necessity requires us to do that. In fact, the German Chancellor, Herr Wolf von Bethmann-Hollweg, said in the Reichstag, he said, well, this does violate our treaty commitment, but necessity knows no law. That's one thing people who are supporters of a powerful state will always think the interests of the state really trump other people's rights. They think they can do really whatever they want to advance the power of the state. So once the Germans did this, this gave the British government, the Prime Minister at that time was Herbert Henry Asquith, he was in the Liberal Party, and the Foreign Minister was Sir Edward Grey, later Viscount Grey. So this gave them the excuse they needed to declare war, because remember, the problem for the British was they were committed to come up into this war on the side of the French, but how are they going to get the British public and Parliament to accept this? Well, once Germany violated Belgian neutrality, then the British could say, well, we have to go to war now, because look what the Germans have done to Belgium. We just can't let this go in and take over Belgium. It would be very unfair. So it should be clear that the reason the British intervened was because of its commitments to France, not out of shock at the violation of Belgian neutrality. We can see this if we look at a previous incident. In 1887, there was a crisis, some sort of crisis between Germany and France that involved some colonial dispute. So the British minister to Belgium, Lord Vivian, told the Belgian government that if Germany invaded Belgium to strike at France, then the British would intervene, because at that time the British weren't getting along so well with the French. So they said, well, you know, even if they violate the neutrality, they're not going to do anything. I see neutrality of Belgium would be guaranteed by treaty in 1839, I think it was, of pressure signed. So that's why the German were violating their treaty commitments when they invaded Belgium. Now, one thing I think is, if we're trying to look at this question of war responsibility, we should take account of both Britain and Germany. Here, a lot of people, a lot of historians will not give any, that the British really weren't involved in war, don't get any real responsibility for the war. They came in on the French and Russian side, but they didn't really have anything to do with starting the war. We have to take account of the fact that Britain and Germany were the most powerful members of the two rival alliance systems. So I don't think we can acquit the British of responsibility altogether. And one thing to take on especially is the British ambassador to Russia, Sir George Buchanan, was sympathetic to Sazonov. He was said to him something like, well, you know, you've got to avoid making it seem that you're provoking war by mobilizing. But he was fairly sympathetic to Sazonov, although the Russians were completely honest about what they were planning. Now, to those of you who've studied his career, it'll come as no surprise that the person in the British cabinet who was the most ardent advocate for war was Winston Churchill, who was the First Lord of the Admiralty. That's the equivalent to Secretary of the Navy in the American cabinet. So he was, throughout his career, he was always in favor of war. He thought this would be a really, 1914 would be a really good chance to get a war against Germany going. And he mobilized the British fleet on July 28th, which was a very provocative gesture. So he was one of those who was very much pushing for war. Now, we have to ask, well, why did the British get involved? Rather, they made some treaty commitments to France, but why are they, were they so insistent in getting involved? Now, the key here is that Britain had a long-standing aim of preventing any European power from dominating the continent. So the fact that Germany was rising in its power would automatically get the British very upset. They'd say, well, we don't want the Germans, say the Germans were able to defeat France and Russia, then they'd get to be much too powerful. So just as in the Napoleonic Wars, when the British were very concerned about France dominating the continent, they were very concerned about the Germans not being able to secure the position of European dominance. And also, Britain wanting to make sure, wanting to block Germany from rivaling it as a world power. If Germany was able to defeat France and Russia, that would, then the Germans could start threatening, build up their navy and threaten the British navy. And Britain would no longer be the world's dominant power, so that would be one reason the British were very interested in stopping the Germans getting involved in the war. But from these are all considered the British, but there wasn't any reason for the U.S. to be interested in supporting these British goals. I mean, this might have been in the British national interest, but that doesn't mean it was in the American national interest. Now, Theodore Roosevelt thought it was in our interest to intervene because he thought if the Germans ever got control of the Atlantic, this would threaten us, but it isn't clear why that would be true anymore than say British control of the Atlantic in the years before 1914 would be a threat to us. So it isn't clear why which nation is the most powerful one in Europe would should be of concern to the U.S., even though Theodore Roosevelt and a few others were concerned. But almost all Americans at the time wanted to stay out of the war. people at that time had the attitude that, well, you know, this is one of these typical European power struggles. This is just the sort of thing that the founding fathers warned us about, so we want to stay out of that. And the president, Woodrow Wilson, first proclaimed American neutrality. He said, we're neutral in this war. And he called for Americans to be neutral in thought as well as deed. That's a quotation from one of his speeches. So he said, we shouldn't take sides. We should just be neutral about this. But even though he said that, he himself wasn't neutral in thought as well as deed. He was an ardent Anglophile. He was very much in love with England and English institutions. And so I think, at least according to most accounts, he did at first want to stay out of the war. He was by no means neutral. Now, there is one account by the head of the Committee on Public Information, George Creel, the chief American propagandist during World War I. He said Wilson wanted to get into the war from the first, but that's probably not true. That if that was true, Wilson would have been a complete liar. It does appear most people think, most of the historians think, Wilson at first did want to stay out of the war. But in looking at Wilson's personality, you have to consider he was a very difficult person. He was very sure of himself. He tended to approach matters in kind of a very legalistic spirit. And Theodore Roosevelt, who had a kind of very funny phrase for Wilson, said he had the personality of a Byzantine logos thief. Does anyone know what a logos thief is? Well, it was a kind of an administrative official in the Byzantine Empire. So what Roosevelt was suggesting was Wilson isn't somebody who's really a creative person, can just apply bureaucratic rules very narrowly. I've always liked that phrase, Byzantine logos thief. It has a certain ring to it, don't you think? So a little bit about Wilson. He believed that the constitutional restraints on American government, remember we have the checks and balances, the limiting the power of the government, he thought this reflected an outdated mechanical philosophy. This was kind of Newtonian science in the 17th, 18th century, would talk about balances of power. But 19th century, that was the century of Darwin. Now we thought we were concerned with kind of organic development. Government should be organic, just like a living body. So instead of having checks and balances, the government should be considered like one living body, and together with the people, it would be leading the people, kind of the head leading the body. And in his book, Congressional Government, which came out in 1885, Wilson praised the British system of parliamentary supremacy. He said, instead of having this Congress divided from the president, the British system where the prime minister must have a majority in parliament was much more efficient. They can get things done much better. So he favored, in 1805, he favored parliamentary supremacy. He later changed his mind about that. He favored more executive control still. The president then would be dominating. In other words, he wanted control by himself. Instead of having a limited government, he would be the one in control. Now, his closest advisor was a rather mysterious figure, Edward Mandell House. House was usually called Colonel House, but this is just an honorary colonel. We're just like you have Kentucky colonels, it's kind of not real people in the military that just get kind of an honorary title. A House with an honorary Texas colonel. And it turned out he was an even bigger Anglophile than Woodrow Wilson. So Wilson was very pro-English, but House was even more pro-English. And in a novel, and came out in 1912, called Philip Drew Administrator. House wrote about a progressive leader who conquers America. There in this novel of the Civil War, the progressive leader takes over, and then he rules America as a dictator. So this rather shows how he thought of Woodrow Wilson, thought Wilson should really be in control, and he would be the advisor helping Wilson out. It wasn't really in accord at all with American tradition of limited government. So we have these two Anglophiles, and then there's a third very important Anglophile. The American ambassador to London, Walter Hines Page, was also extremely pro-British. And when, as we'll see in a few minutes, why there were sometimes American protests against British policy, when there would be diplomatic messages from the American government criticizing British policy, Walter Hines Page would work with the British Foreign Secretary, Lord Grey, in deciding how the British should reply to these diplomatic complaints. So he was acting as if he's really in the British Foreign Service rather than as he was American ambassador. So we have then kind of these very pro-British, Wilson said we're going to be neutral, but in fact we have this very pro-British people who are in the key policy-making roles. Now, another factor that strongly inclined the U.S. in the British direction of intervening on the side of the British, one of the most powerful banking interests in the U.S. was the House of Morgan. J.P. Morgan was born in England, but he'd come over and prosper in America. Now, the Morgan Bank was the fiscal agent of Bank of England. It was also in charge of financing British and French war bonds in the U.S. So they had a big stake in supporting the British and getting the U.S. involved. Murray Rothbard was very much the one who stressed the role of Morgan. And so what he emphasized, what Rothbard emphasized, was that the Morgan interests weren't just concerned with getting profit from these war bonds, though of course that was a big thing they cared about. But for them, the interests of Great Britain and the British Empire were paramount. And the Morgan Bank always aimed to subordinate the interests of the United States to the superior power, to the British. And according to Rothbard, after the onset of World War I, to quote him, the Morgans played a substantial role in bringing the United States into the war on the British side. Now, say they wanted their various forces, including the House of Morgan, want to get the U.S. into the war on the British side, but there's a problem. Remember, most Americans didn't want to get into the war. And in fact, there was one financier named Roger Bacon, not the medieval scientist, but an American financier, who thought that at the time the war began, no more than about 50,000 people in the whole United States wanted to get into the war on the British, French, and Russian side. So how are they going to do this? How are they going to get the U.S. people interested in intervening? Well, they realized it would be very important to launch a propaganda campaign. And the campaign they launched stressed German atrocities, especially in Belgium. Remember, the Germans had gone into Belgium because they needed to do that because the war plan called for it, so they were violating Belgian neutrality, which was against international law. And the Germans did, in fact, follow very severe policy toward Belgian civilians who fought against them. The German policy was, if you're not in uniform and you're fighting against us, even though you're defending your own country, you have no right as a civilian to fight the army. People who did that were subject to execution. But even though the Germans were following this very severe policy, most of these atrocity stories were largely made up. They would be stories, say, of cutting off hands of babies or raping nuns. These were made up. And unfortunately, many of the leading British intellectuals were involved in the propaganda campaign. And for example, the great British historian, political scientist, Lord Bryce, made known as the American Commonwealth. He was the greatest British authority on the American government. He was one of the leaders of the propaganda campaign. Now, the success of the British propaganda depended to a large degree on payments to newspapers or to movie producers, other outlets. They kind of bought their way into the American public by giving money to the press and other outlets. And here the key figure was Samuel Insull. He had been born in England, but became an American citizen. He was still very pro-British. And he was one of the wealthiest people in America. He had been a disciple of Thomas Edison, and Edison had given him stock in his company, becoming enormously wealthy. So he controlled a large number of utility companies. He was one of the wealthiest people in America, and he was the principal person financing British propaganda. Now, although the Morgan interest in British propaganda played major role in America's going to war, it doesn't follow from that it was inevitable that the U.S. got involved in the war. We shouldn't think, well, once the Morgan interests in the British propaganda campaign got started, then this made it inevitable that the U.S. would go to war. According to what I think is still the best book on the subject by the historian Charles Countanzel, America Goes to War, the decision to go to war always remained Wilson's. It wasn't inevitable. There were all these forces, the Morgan Bank and British propaganda, who were trying to get us involved in the war, but it still was Wilson's decision. And here, Tansel differed from the conclusions of the Nye Committee in the 30s. This was a Senate committee chaired by Gerald Nye, I think the senator from North Dakota, that emphasized very much banking interests and munitions makers as responsible for America's entry into the war. But Tansel, although he recognized the importance of Morgan's interest, he said, no, it was really, everything was up to Wilson. The defining decision maker was up to Wilson. Now, the basic reason America got involved in the war was the violation of America's rights to the neutral power. What had happened was Britain, in an effort to starve Germany, declared a blockade of the North Sea. So under the terms of this blockade, neutral ships that tried to bring in food to Germany would be subject to capture. So the British said, if you try to bring food to Germany, we'll just capture you, and we won't let you do it. Not only won't we let you do it, we'll confiscate your ship, we'll take it to a neutral port, and we'll take it to a port, and then we'll have a prize court, and we'll seize the ship. So when the British did this, this violated generally accepted norms of international law, because a legal blockade is required to be close. By that, I mean, you couldn't just say, well, we're going to blockade this large area, the North Sea, that the British weren't fully in control of today. You could only blockade, blockade the coast. If you were in control of the coast, you could do that. Also, it wasn't legal to class food as contraband. You couldn't starve people out. And earlier, the British Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, remember the great 19th century Prime Minister, they recognized this point that you can't class food as contraband. And about 700,000 people in Germany died as a result of this starvation blockade. So you can see this is a pretty, very severe measure the British did. Now, in response to the British blockade, the Germans declared it would launch submarine attacks against armed British merchant ships. This violated international law, because in international law, if you're going to launch an attack on a merchant ship, you have to give notice that you were going to launch the attack, giving the crew and passengers the time to escape. But if you're in a submarine, you couldn't do that, because if you just basically surfaced that we're going to launch a torpedo against you, the ship would just fire at you or drop depth charges on you. So it would be suicidal for a submarine commander to do that. So the Germans said, well, we're just going to launch these submarine attacks against ships in retaliation for the blockade. So Wilson, you see, both the Germans and the British were violating their neutral rights, or at least certainly British were, that we can't bring contraband in, and the Germans possibly were, although, as we'll see, this is somewhat disputable. But what Wilson did was that he sent notes saying that he insists on strict accountability for violations of American rights, but he didn't do much about British violations. He sort of sent the British, you know, this is not such a good thing to do, but you're trying to interfere with American ships, but he didn't really pursue the matter much. Now, when I said there's some question about whether the Germans, they were certainly violating international law by the submarine attack, but it isn't clear they're violating American rights, because the standard understanding of international law was that people who travel on an armed merchant ship did so at their own risk. But Wilson didn't accept this. His view was, Wilson said, was, American citizens on armed merchant ships were under U.S. protection, even though this wasn't the usual understanding of international law at the time. But this is what Wilson said. And in the most famous instance, the RMS Lusitania, RMS rather than HMS, if you think, His Majesty's ship, HMS, but it's RMS, it's the Royal Mail ship. The Lusitania was an armed ship. It was armed with various shells, gun shells. It was sunk by a German submarine on May 6, 1915, and about 1,195 civilians were killed, and these included 128 Americans. So this created a big shock in America that 128 Americans had been killed. Of course, this number, even the total number of civilians, it's far less than the number of died as a result of the British hunger blockade. But this is kind of more direct, these submarine attacks, torpedo attacks, the very immediate and direct thing. So Wilson sent a message after the thing in Lusitania. He then sent a message to Germany calling on Germany to stop submarine warfare. So the Secretary of State at the time was William Jennings Bryan, who had run for president before he won. He was defeated by McKinley, a famous person in the Cross of Gold speech, and who later became notorious in the Scopes trial on evolution. This is the William Jennings Bryan. He said, we're being very unneutral because we're very severe on Germany, but we're not doing much about British violation of neutral rights. So he resigned. He said, Wilson's so unneutral, I'm resigning. So then the Germans continue their submarine warfare. And then March 1916, the Sussex, which was a cross-channel ferry boat, the Germans made a mistake. They thought the ship was a mine layer, but it was really a ferry boat. So they sank it, there's a loss of 25 American lives. So Wilson then denounced Germany in a speech to Congress in the next month, in April 1960. So the Germans were then very afraid. Well, they said, we don't want America coming into the war against us. So the Germans promised to end submarine attacks on merchant ships. They said, all right, we're not going to attack these ships anymore with submarines. And then Wilson, in 1916, campaigned on the slogan, he kept us out of war. So Wilson is still at that time saying we don't want to get involved in war. And he campaigned on this slogan, he kept us out of war, even though he'd been very neutral in how he'd been much more severe on German violations or what Germans had done to what he was on what the British had done. But then in January 1917, the Germans thought they had a chance to knock out the French, Russians, and British very quickly. They thought if they resumed unrestricted submarine warfare, they could really knock them out before America could come in. So they resumed unrestricted submarine warfare, and Wilson then decided on war. And one thing that really didn't help matters if we're concerned with avoiding war was the publication of Zimmerman telegram in March 1917. Now, Alfred Zimmerman was the secretary in the German Foreign Office. He was a very high official. And he, at the time, people realized it looked like America might get involved in the war. So he had discussed a plan, sent a proposal to the Mexican government that if Mexico got involved, entered the war against America, Mexico declared war on the U.S. If the U.S. entered the war against Germany, if Mexico then declared war on the U.S., then they would try to get back territory that had been lost in the Mexican War 1846-1848. So if you come in to the war on our side against the U.S., if the U.S. gets in, then we'll help you get back the territory you lost in 1846-1848. So the British decoded this telegram and was published in March. So this really kind of helped Wilson in his decision to go to war. This people in the U.S. didn't like this very much. So in April 1917, Wilson asked Congress for a declaration of war. And in his speech, he didn't confine himself to protests against violations of American rights and neutral power. He did, of course, he mentioned that Germany had resumed submarine warfare. This was not acceptable. But he went far beyond that. He portrayed the war as an ideological struggle between democracy and autocracy. He said America and Britain or France or the democratic forces were fighting Prussian autocracy. Now, fortunately for him, you could say, well, what about Tsarist Russia? Well, remember in early February 1917, the Tsarist government had been overthrown. It was no longer a czarist. He couldn't very well say it's this war between democracy and autocracy. The czarist Russia's on the side he's fighting for, but things were, after this Federal Revolution, he could then say it's a war between democracy and autocracy. And he had in his speech famous sentence, the world must be made safe for democracy. So this suggested he was interested in some sort of ideological battle to reform the various powers of Europe. It was certainly not American foreign policy had been in the 19th century, not what Washington, Jefferson had in mind. So I think we'll stop here, and the rest of the time we can have questions. So I'll go to the Q&A panel. So please type your question into that if you have objections. Now, Brian said, the reading assigned for class today was amazing. That's one by Ralph Ray. However, I would like for you to clarify post-World War I Polish. How were the Germans discriminated against? Well, what you had, it's a good question, Brian. What you had here, first of all, there was Germany lost a good deal of territory to Poland. So a lot of East Prussia was taken over by Poland. And then the city of Danzig, which was a German city, was not part of Poland, was really under Polish control. So it was taken over by Poland. Then there were other areas. There was supposed to be a plebiscite in Silesia, where there were both Germans and Poles. And even though most of the people in the plebiscite voted for Germany, most of the territory was awarded to Poland. Now, the discrimination against the Poles was really, against the Germans who were living in Poland, was really, there was a very strong Polish nationalist movement under Marshal Pilsudski. They were making sure that the Poles were in control of the government, and the Germans didn't get as many benefits in education and government as the Poles did, so that was the discrimination. Ivan says, why was Winston Churchill so obsessed with war? Well, it's hard to say. That would be a matter of individual psychology, but it was a dominant theme in his life. He really enjoyed war. He'd been in, he fought in the Sudan. He was in the Boer War. Remember, he was stationed with the Spanish Army in the Spanish-American War. He seemed like he really enjoyed a good battle. So, I would say that would be more a matter of his individual psychology. Now, Ivan says, another question. In the 1895 territorial dispute about Venezuela and British Guiana, presumably British Guiana was an English colony. Yes, that's right. What about Venezuela? Well, Venezuela was an independent country. What did the English and American governments think of Venezuela and the claims of the golden theory? Well, the British didn't accept these claims because they said, we want the gold to be in our territory. The Americans, basic thing the Americans were saying was, they thought that the British, in trying to press the claims of their colony, were violating the Monroe Doctrine. Because remember, the Monroe Doctrine didn't say the British can't have colonies in Latin America. It said we're not going to interfere with your existing colonies. So we're not going to say you have to give up British Guiana. But the Americans said if you're trying to extend the territory, that violates the provision of the Monroe Doctrine that said no new colonization in Latin America. And then the British said in response that, you know, okay, this is what the Monroe Doctrine says, but who cares about that other than you? This isn't something we've accepted, not part of international law. Brian says, what do you think is the best book about British propaganda during World War One? Well, there were several good studies. There's, let me just give you some, let me just see if I could give you the exact title here. Could you, hold, let me just look, I have this written down here actually. One sec, I just have this written down. Right. Well, I can't find my note. I'll just have to give you I think I'll just have to give you this from I think there's one that was very good with wait, this didn't cut. Oh, this didn't send. Well, the book I had in mind, it's not sending. It's by Arthur Ponsonby, Ponsonby, called Falsehood in Wartime. He was Sir Arthur Ponsonby, later Lord Ponsonby, was a labor peer. I think that's one of the best books. There are others, like H.C. Peterson has a book on this. The American political scientist Harold Lasswell also wrote on this. I can get these titles for you later, but there are a number. I'm not, when I the box that I was typing in this thing isn't going up, so that's why I'm having trouble. I suppose I could put it in the chat. Maybe I'll, let me just put this in the chat thing here for one sec here. Okay, that was, now we're back to the Q&A. Okay, so we're ready. If we have more questions in the Q&A box. Now, Justin said, what was the context for Wilson saying Edward House was his second personality? Well, I think that was just a general comment he meant about that House was always advising him. He thought House really knew exactly what he was thinking, and they were extremely close. Personally, there was a book by Alexander George on the Wilson-House relationship. They actually split during the peace conference in Paris, and then they had a falling out because House didn't get along with the second Mrs. Wilson. Now, Peter says, was Wilson's decision to go to war influenced by the House of Morgan? Well, the House of Morgan was certainly pressuring for war, but I think Wilson's decision was more based on his own feelings of being very pro-British, plus his view that the Germans had resumed submarine warfare, and then he had view that he would remake the world in accordance with according to this crusade for democracy. Ivan, I believe you, meaning me, also wrote an essay on war propaganda yourself, didn't you? Is there any way you could provide it to me? Did I write? Well, I had one, I think, on, this is on World War II, various figures in World War II who were interested in propaganda. I think it's in the book Costs of War, edited by John Denson. If you go to the Mises website, that should be available for download, so you could probably get it there if you're interested. It's very kind of you. If you want to look up my essay, if I did write such an essay, and I can never remember what I wrote, but I'll take your word for it. Okay, we still have more time for questions. here's some more. Matthew says, was there much of an arms race in the build-up to the war? Yes, there was. I mean, both the Germans and French were especially building up the up their arms. And the British were also very interested in building up their navy. You know, there was a slogan, "We want eight and we won't wait," meaning eight dreadnought battleships. So there was an arms race. The best source on that, if you look in Sidney Fay's book, Origins of the War, get the 1930 edition. First edition came out in 1928. 1930 edition, Sidney Fay, is very good, discusses the arms race as one of the causes of the war. I think he has several different, you know, he has the alliance systems, nationalism, imperialism, build up of arms, and newspaper propaganda. Justin says, Mises claimed that Menger predicted World War I, but did Menger ever actually write about it? Well, I'm not aware that he did, but I don't really know Menger's writing sufficiently to be confident about it. I'm not familiar with anything that Menger wrote on that, but I really don't know. Brian says, how is Belgium able to remain neutral for most of its history? Well, remember, Belgium wasn't in existence as a separate country for that long. It was only after the Congress of Vienna. So basically, I think it was in the interests of the various European powers not to have Belgium on one side or the other, because, say, if say France took it over, say France took over Belgium, obviously powers hostile to France wouldn't like that. So they thought, and similarly, France wouldn't like it if Belgium, say, went over to Germany. So it was kind of a compromise. They would say Belgium could be neutral, both sides would respect that. And to the extent that both sides respected, both France and Germany respected Belgian neutrality, then this would kind of, Belgium would kind of be, act as a buffer, and it would be discourage war. Now, Joel asking, who's going to say, Anglophile on continent mean one who favors politically and military alliances with England, or does it have its normal meaning? No, I would say more, it has the normal meaning, meaning someone who is an admirer of Britain or British institution, and that one of the causal consequences of that was that there would be a tendency to support England in its struggles with other countries. And Joel says, in either case, why are so many people in American politics Anglophone? Well, I think a lot of the elite groups viewed themselves as, really, they viewed England as kind of the more civilized nation in America. They kind of looked down, some of the elites, especially in the East, kind of looked down on the bulk of the American people as uncultured, said, well, we're really interested in these upper class English people. We'd like to be like them. And then there was also a movement kind of saying, stressing that sort of racial theories were very popular though in those days. There was a movement saying the America was largely populated by, dominated by Anglo-Saxons, and we were sort of the same people as the English, that the Anglo-Saxon race would be, should be controlled. There's Henry Cabot Lodge, who was a senator, is very much a strong advocate of getting into the war on the British side, was very much influenced by this sort of theory. So it was just a lot. I mean, there have been, of course, there were Americans who studied in Germany also, but they weren't as influential in German universities. Well, they tended not to be as influential as the ones who looked to England. Now, Leslie said, there's an interesting YouTube video of Poincaré's statement to Russia in the summer of 1940. Just after he returned to France, he ordered mobilization or return of French foreign from Africa to France. In Russia, they planned for the war. Well, that's very much disputed, and Poincaré in his memoirs didn't really say what he had promised the Russians. I mean, they probably discussed mobilization with them, but you know, it's not clear, given them that it was the French ambassador to Russia named Viviani was also involved in these. I mean, clearly the French were going to support the Russians if they did decide for mobilization. Now, Brian says, if Henry Cabot Lodge was eager to enter World War I, why would he later reject Wilson's 14 points? Well, he wanted to enter World War I, but he didn't like this idea of a kind of a crusade to make the world safe for democracy. He was someone who said, well, we've got to increase American power. He wanted, kind of, he favored more of a preponderant league, say, an alliance between America and England, kind of would dominate European politics. He thought that Wilson's was sort of, he didn't like this kind of ideological warfare. So he is a supporter of what the plan by William Howard Capon, the League to Enforce Peace. So he wanted sort of, someone was more interested in American, direct American dominance than Wilson, who was saying we want to have a League of Nations where we're going to have all the nations that would be part of a single or a group, and then they can reinforce to get against anyone who disturbs the peace. Henry Cabot Lodge is saying, no, we have to stress American interests more. We're not going to get involved. We don't want to get involved in anything like the League of Nations or a World Court. Okay, let's see. Anybody have anything? Now, someone says there wasn't much mention of Turkey's role in World War I. Well, they didn't get involved. They got involved after the war started. Of course, the Russians, remember when they wanted to get control of the Straits of Constantinople, that would be taking something from Turkey. So, I mean, I don't think the Turks weren't a major factor in war's origins, though. Well, now, Tim, I think, asked a question. Did the plan discussed in Zimmerman telegram just diffuse altogether? Was Maxwell ever really on board? Actually, what happened was the president of Mexico, I think his name Carranza, I'm not talking about, he thought this is over, and he said that, look, if we get involved in the U.S., we're going to lose. We're not getting involved. So he rejected the Zimmerman proposal. I don't think they were really, so nothing came. I mean, the Mexican government explicitly rejected them. Justin said, there's some propaganda that Germany was going to invade America by air. There was a little bit. I don't think that was one of the main things of the stress, but people were talking about maybe they'll send over dirigibles and other things. And they're planning to come over. There were various movies that portrayed the Germans in a very bad light, and the Beasts of Berlin, there was a very active propaganda campaign. But I think you're right, that was one of the things. I wouldn't think it was a dominant thing, but it was. People did mention that. Brian said, do you believe the British created the immigrant charter? Oh, no, no, this wasn't authentic telegram. The British decoded it, but it wasn't a hoax. No, I mean, that Alfred Zimmerman was an official in the German Foreign Office, and he really did suggest this to the Mexicans. Okay, well, we have a few minutes left. anyone have any objections to any of the arguments? I love objections, especially if I can answer them. Objections I can answer are a different matter, of course. What is your personal opinion on World War I, good or bad? Well, of course, it was very bad and it was a disaster. I mean, look at all the millions of people who were killed, and it led to the rise of communism, the rise. Hitler was one of the worst events of the 20th century. I can't see anything good about it. Not even a little good. Well, what, Justin, that's it. What would you have in mind as something that was good about it, if that's your view? Oh, he's just trying to get a rise from me. Well, that's hard to do. It can be done, but it's hard to do. Now, Ivan says, what do you think of Hans Hoppe's view that World War I was the end of civilization? Well, I think there's a great deal to be said for that. I mean, we had kind of a collapse of the whole European order, which had been, remember, the 19th century was largely a peaceful one. But World War I ended that. Now, Leslie says, was the Lusitania sent out as a sitting duck? I think some people have argued this. Well, it appears, again, that Churchill, who knew that the Lusitania was likely to be attacked, but he more or less encouraged the captain to go into the area. And I think the British were aware that if they sent a ship out that the Germans were very likely to attack it. Remember, the Germans had actually published warnings in the New York newspaper shortly before the Lusitania was sailed, said, look, passengers who go on this are doing so at their own risk. I think there was some awareness that they were going to be, since it was such a big ship, that they were going to attack it. Now, Joel said, some say the harsh term the Allies subjected Germany to at the end of World War I led to Hitler and eventually World War II. Yes, I think, remember in Hitler's speeches, in the speech of the Nazi Party, one thing they stressed was that the Versailles Treaty was very unjust, and this was the principal theme of the Nazi propaganda, so I think it did play a big role in the causing World War II and rise of Hitler. Okay, well, I guess, does anyone have a last question? I think we're about out of time now, but anyone have anything? Did Germany Ryan said, did Germany have any response to British propaganda? Well, the Germans had propaganda of their own, but because of the way the British was in control of the American press, it didn't get as much attention. I mean, there were various German writers and people in favor of the Germans who wrote books and articles defending them. I mean, there was a German propaganda agency. The art historian Abi Warburg was one who was kind of collecting material to help the Germans, and there were various other people. There was a great American political scientist, John W. Burgess, was one who was sympathetic to the Germans and wrote on them. Hugo Munsterberg was a professor at Harvard, but they didn't have any, they weren't as much, their propaganda activities were less, much less than the British propaganda. Someone wants to know which book from Council. It's America Goes to War, came out in 1938. It's on one of their slides. You'll be able to see it. Well, okay, well, thanks everybody. So thanks for coming to the lecture, and next week we'll be getting into World War II. So thanks a lot, everybody. Hope we'll see you all next week. And I hope everybody has a happy Thanksgiving. Bye, everybody.